Hey, this is BT Wolf, and you're listening to Orange Juice for the Ears on Dublab. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Victoria Brokes, world-class curator and exhibition maker who co-created the runaway success David Bowie Is. And Victoria is also the current director of the London Design Biennale. Before that, Vicky was head of exhibitions for the V&A Department of Theatre and Performance and artistic director for the London Design Festival. Along with Brokes co-creating David Bowie Is in 2013, which was the fastest selling exhibition in the V&A's history, she developed a string of other popular music displays, including The Story of the Supremes, Pink Floyd, Annie Lennox, You Say You Want a Revolution, and the list just goes on. And in 2019, she was appointed director of the London Design Biennale. In my time of knowing her, I've never encountered a more forward-thinking, ingenious, and passionate curator than Vicky. So much of what the museum world desperately needs. So, Vicky, it's so lovely to have you join us today. Where are you speaking to us from?
It's so lovely to be here, BC. And I'm speaking to you from London, from West London. And pretty dreary weather here, I'm afraid.
Oh, well, you know, I guess that's just...
London. Yeah, it's what we expect here, for sure.
Okay, so the subject of this show, it's called Orange Juice for the Ears, and the title is taken from a line by neurologist Oliver Sacks about the power of music and how deep that really goes. And the line is, music can lift us out of a depression or move us to tears. It's a remedy, a tonic, an orange juice for the ear. And I just want to know, what does that quote mean to you?
Well, I think that that is, you know, a way of putting something that I hold very dear myself. The power of music to, I suppose, it kind of transcends everything else, and it speaks directly to your soul. And there's a sort of strange universality of that, and also an individuality. So we don't all respond to the same music, but by and large, I'd say we all respond to some music. And I think one of the things I've always loved about music is you kind of can't tell people what to think. And that's very different to the world that I suppose, in terms of professionally, grew up working in, where we spent our lives kind of telling people what to think. And what I loved particularly about music was that we all know what we like and love and what speaks to us. And no amount of saying, oh, well, this one's better than that, is really going to make a difference to that. And I think that's a wonderful thing, because it indicates the power that music has to speak to you directly, and the confidence we can have in us to respond to that.
And because, you know, as you said, it's not really a thinking response, it's a feeling response. So it's something that doesn't really work on a intellectual or an analytical process, which is often how we handle a lot of other things, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like it moves in the air, like smoke or particles or whatever. You can then sort of analyse what it is that's in there, but that's not what gets you in the first place. It's the direct connection from sort of sound to brain.
Perfect. And that kind of ties into what I was going to share, you know, initially, which is how we connected, which was through this musical jacket that I created. And I think it was in 2016, you were doing the Records and Rebels exhibition. And I ended up being a part of that through the musical jacket. And then obviously we went on to get to work together on other things. But I remember from our first conversation just how much, you know, how present music was for you as one of the mediums that you were working in.
Yeah. And for me, it was one of the kind of great accidental, like so many things happen in one's life that isn't exactly kind of as you planned it. But, you know, I started working at the V&A really a very long time ago. And I would have loved to have worked in music. It was my great love, but I didn't feel I had any qualifications for that. And I didn't know any people in the music business and so on. And probably, actually, now that I do know quite a few people in the music business, probably jolly good thing that, yeah, that didn't happen. However, I worked in the museum business, and what I then, years later, uncovered, not that it was hidden in plain sight, was that we had these fabulous collections around music, all the sort of visual things like your jacket. I mean, nothing quite like your jacket, but the costume and the designs and the graphics and the record covers. And we, the V&A and forward-thinking curators way back in the 60s, had been collecting that from the outset, but they hadn't really been shown in a musical context. And bringing that together with my thinking, which was always, about 10% of people are interested in art and design, which is what our museum was about. But about 99% or more are interested in music. So what better way to actually interest people in what you've kind of got to show?
Yeah, using the music as a kind of glue to bring it all together.
Exactly, exactly right. That was the sort of core of that exhibition, the You Say You Want a Revolution exhibition, in 2016, was to take the amazing music that you were very into as well from the late 60s, which not only was great music, but it also was central to all the things that were going on around in society at the time. So it was possible to start with that and then to go on a journey in all sorts of different directions using that as a sort of navigation for it.
We're going to get into all of that a little later on, but with that as the perfect environment to now talk about the first song that imprinted on you, what would that be, Vicky?
Well, that is Ode to Billy Joe by Bobby Gentry. My mother had the album, and I remember hearing the song as a child, and as one does as a child, you just absorb not just the music but the words. But of course, and you know, I now know that the intrigue around the words went way beyond my childhood imagination. You know, there have been all kinds of sort of stories written about it. But for me, as a fairly young child, it just sort of ignited all of these imaginings. And it's also a really, really beautiful song. So I don't know how old I was when I first heard it, but I haven't tired of it yet.
So we're now going to take a listen to Ode to Billy Joe by Bobby Gentry.
Papa said to Mama as he passed around the black-eyed peas, "Well, Billy Joe never had a lick of sense. Pass the biscuits, please." He said he saw a girl that looked a lot like you up on Choctaw Ridge, and she and Billy Joe was throwing something off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
And that was Ode to Billy Joe by Bobby Gentry, and that was the song that Victoria Brokes chose as the first track that imprinted on her. And you said you didn't know how old you were when you heard it, but roughly, I mean, 4 or 5 or older?
Yes, probably 4 or 5. And yeah, it stayed with me, the description of Deep South and, you know, dusty Delta plains and so on, which for a home counties child was kind of unimaginable. Of course, I didn't even know what the words were. The Tallahassee Bridge, I think, mispronounced and so on. And there were whole phrases that I actually got wrong, you know, and imagined other different things. But hey, none of that matters. It was a route. It was a opening of other worlds. But with this just beautiful tune and guitar and, you know, I think it's a really lovely, lovely song.
And it's also an incredible story, you know, and obviously you wouldn't have picked up on all of that necessarily as a kid. But, you know, knowing you and knowing what a lover of great stories you are and how to tell those stories in that kind of multi-layered way, and you know, maybe not everyone will pick up on all of the layers, do you think there was something about that song that, you know, ignited a love of storytelling, or was that already present?
I don't know. I mean, it's certainly the story was totally intriguing, you know, who were these characters, what had been thrown off the bridge. Also that thing about parents sort of carrying on as if nothing's happened. I think I was struck by that as well, you know, past the black-eyed peas in the middle of this, you know, highly dramatic situation. As with all memories, you don't know which bit you got when. But yeah, fantastic storytelling. And I think, you know, because subsequently read up about it, many, many more verses originally. And so maybe the story was told in more detail. But with the compactness of it, it's kind of all there, but it's not. And it leaves so many doors open, and that leads you through to what else could have been. Mm. And you can make your own story.
Wonderful. And you mentioned briefly just how different this world was that you were hearing about, how, you know, listening to that record kind of opened up these other worlds that you weren't aware of. Tell us more about growing up in, did you grow up in Berkshire?
I did. Well, we moved out of London to Berkshire when I was quite little, and lived sort of proper country for, you know, a few years, and then actually came back to London. I came back to school in London, but it was lovely. It was on a farm, and there were cows and horses and animals of all kinds, and brothers, no sisters, lots of animals. I think it was animals all the way was my interest then. So I don't remember the storytelling, but I do remember the music. We had these gigantic speakers. I mean, my parents really loved their music too. And in those days, if you wanted good sound, you needed enormous speakers, and they were so big. I and this is just absurd, and yet it's true. I actually thought there were people in the speakers, you know, because they were that big. I thought maybe the people were in there making music.
That's amazing. If we all just had, you know, the Beatles in our room singing to us.
Yes. We had mainly classical music of all kinds. Actually, my mother loved not just classical music, actually. I mean, they had all this sort of 50s music and things. My mother particularly loved all kinds of music. But the only pop music we had was Bobby Gentry, The Beatles, and a few random things. We had a single of Sunny Afternoon by The Kinks, actually, as well, which was very good choice, I think.
Oh, yeah. Favourite. My number one, Kinks.
So limited choice. But of course, as we all had in those days, when you had a limited choice, you knew everyone, and you sort of did everyone, and you knew every word on every bit and where they were physically on the record and all of that sort of thing.
Well, and it imprinted, you know, something I bang on about is obviously, you know, when we moved from physical to digital, we lost a lot of that ceremony and the storytelling tangibility, and that the value, you know, suddenly having everything at our fingertips, but actually limitations. Human beings kind of need limitations, and it's amazing how when it was limited and it was tangible, ceremonial, all of those things, it could go in deep and stay with you in a way that was a part of you and, you know, forever changed you. So
yeah, and I think that's right. And I think the physicality was also, in a sense, like a sort of map, a kind of tool. You know, I remember you would know which track and where the track was. And my older brother, who's a great musician, classical pianist, and so on, and was sort of super careful about his record collection, like you weren't allowed to touch. So I was taught how to sort of spin records by holding them on the edges. And, you know, I could lift a needle, drop it into exactly the right place, and all of that sort of thing. I was very, very proud of all those skills, which, of course, now, what on earth was all that about? But it mattered a lot when you were a teenager.
Before we get to the teenage years, what were you like as a kid? You know, how did you spend your time? And were you interested in, you know, other art forms as well? And you were musical. I read somewhere that you played instruments. And
I did. I mean, I think probably the most sort of creative thing that I did was didn't know you were going to ask these kind of questions. I used to put on operas with my animals. I mean, not the live animals, the sort of toy animals. I had these little tiny sort of rubber animals. I can't remember what they were called, but I had an enormous set of them. Well, not enormous, enough though to do an opera. And I had a sort of farm, like a doll's house, but it was a farm. And I used to get the records, my parents' records, which were, you know, highlights of Aida or Rigoletto or whatever, or Carmen. We had Carmen Jones, actually, that was fantastic. And I would put on the show with these little animals and make everyone watch them, which must have been absolutely unbearable. But I enjoyed it. Yeah, and I did quite a lot of drawing and stuff like that. I wasn't particularly sociable. I mean, I grew up to be much more sociable than I was as a child. I think I, like a lot of children, thought only the animals really understood me. Very happy with my own company. Yeah, and it was a happy childhood, just sort of bobbing along.
It sounds like your animal operas became the blueprint for your world-class exhibitions, Vicky. Your lucky family, that's what I say.
And I did, you know, I played the piano, and later on I played the cello, and I played the guitar. None of it very well. I sang, and in a way I would have liked to have sung more. I really enjoyed singing, learned how to harmonise from all the, you know, aforementioned records, really. And I think being a backing singer would have suited me quite well.
Perfect. Well, that is a nice lead in to this next question, which is the first album that shaped who you are and had a major impact.
Yeah, so that is Abbey Road. Again, I think I just adored the Beatles. We had every album. For some reason they were on reel-to-reels. So, I mean, we had the albums, but they were recorded onto those reel-to-reels, those great big tapes that you could get two albums on, very good quality. We'd sort of done that somehow. And Abbey Road, again, I like that, nearly all the album, but the medley on the second side, the stories, I suppose, the directions and the journeys that it could take you on. Yeah, I love it.
Okay, wonderful. So now we're going to take a listen to She Came In Through the Bathroom Window off the record Abbey Road classic by the Beatles. She came in through the bathroom window. And that was She Came In Through the Bathroom Window by the Beatles from Abbey Road. And Vicky Brokes chose that as the first record that really imprinted on her. Imprinted had a major impact, which I guess is the same. And you were saying that it was the kind of medley aspect, just all the things that were going on and the story and how it sort of blew your mind. Do you think at that point you had any sense that you wanted to be a curator? Like, was that, you know, even a seed in your mind somewhere?
I don't think I would have had any idea what a curator was. We did go to museums and galleries, as, you know, my parents would take us, particularly that week after Christmas. There was always a sort of London trip and we'd go all over the place. And the other thing, I used to collect coins. And I remember my father taking me to Spink, the auction house that dealt with coins. And it sort of took the interest, you know, when an adult sort of takes your interest and says, we can go somewhere with this, come and find out more, there's lots to know. If you keep going, it'll get more and more interesting. And I think that aspect was definitely encouraged in me. And of course, it's true. You can just take it as it is and stop there, or you can take things as a starting point, and you never know where you're going to end up. You can be led all over the place. That, I suppose, is what does relate to what I've been able to do on those exhibitions.
And you studied history of design at the Royal College of Art. You know, how was that whole experience for you? And, you know, what was that like?
It was absolutely amazing. I would go as far as to say it was probably the only moment of my education where it suddenly all actually started to make sense. Maybe it needs a bit of explaining, but I loved school, but I wasn't particularly driven by academic things. It was all fine. I went to university, I started philosophy, and that I actually really enjoyed philosophy. It was sort of right up my street of the types of questions. I think probably for a lot of young people, it seemed to be addressing exactly the sorts of things that you're thinking all the time, but you actually then you have to sit down and think about them quite hard and work out where they will lead you and what your sort of beliefs are and how you can hold different beliefs and, you know, how you can contradict yourself and what you need to do about it and so on. But none of it sort of seemed to go in any particular direction. When I went, rather randomly, I knew I wanted to work in the arts. Didn't really want to do history of art. I did think it was a bit of a sort of closed world. I didn't really like that aspect of it. History of design seemed to me to be a much more democratic area, but it was much more about the world around it. The Royal College was doing an MA, it was a relatively new MA, and it was just fantastic. I remember just sort of joining and being in an art school. It was a different, whole different scene. That was a wonderful thing. And then actually what we were studying, the way we were studying, was tremendously exciting. And so we kind of did history as one bit, sort of social and economic history, and then we did philosophy, and then we did just going in and being with objects and looking at things and talking about them and being told about them and finding out more about them and so on. And it sort of brought the whole of all of those things together for me, which fed into lots of things I've been interested in before, but hadn't really kind of added up. And on top of all of that, but maybe also actually one of the reasons it was so great, was that because it was a fairly new course, they kept the student numbers really low. And we seem to have almost as many professors as students. And they were passionate about what they were doing. So we didn't just sort of, as it were, go to school and learn stuff. We practically sort of lived together for a couple of years. And we went everywhere. We used to go to the pub. The conversations would kind of go on night and day. And it felt like a really immersive education. Everything felt terribly important. Of course, lots of things that probably weren't very important. But it was immensely enlivening, exciting. And yeah, I finally felt that I sort of knew what I liked doing and what I might go on to do with it.
Amazing. And I know there was a particular professor that really had an impact. Christopher Frayling, was it?
Christopher Frayling, yeah. Yes, he was fantastic. He was the youngest professor, because obviously professors in the UK is different. Not everyone's a professor. You just get one per school, as it were. And he was the youngest professor, I think, in England at the time. And he went on to the Royal College and he went on to run the Arts Council. But that's just sort of testament to how great he was. But he also had these sort of quirky interests, and he was interested in spaghetti westerns. He was an expert on that. He knew Clint Eastwood. He'd been out to interview Clint, actually, while I think I was at college. And no, he hadn't been out there. I think he'd met Clint at Claridge's. And he turned up at Claridge's to interview him in his suite. And Clint was sitting down at the piano and playing fantastic jazz. That's what I remember. And I thought, oh my God, this is so unbelievably cool. I think the thing about Christopher was that he had a massive intellect. He brought the rigour from his background as a Cambridge historian, but he brought it into a popular culture area. And that opened my eyes to the fact that you could do things sort of in the same way and with the same training, with the same outlook and the same rigour, but you could do them about other subjects. You know, you could make these things really interesting, really exciting. And I guess he opened the door to that.
And a specific belief of his was that the conversations about design weren't necessarily happening in the right places. Why was that an important realisation for you?
I think, interesting to say, do you remember saying this, or did you say this even? And this is this what you meant? This is what I inferred from that and have lived on ever since. So if you didn't say it, then that would also be a funny twist to it all. But the thing was that design history was studied sort of on the side by art students, art and design students, practical art and design students. That wasn't their main area of interest. They were just doing it sort of on the edge. And so the design history was not really getting a look in, unlike, say, art history, which had, you know, great minds focused on great departments, great schools, great courses and so on, because it had a sort of prestige value. And he sought to bring design, the standard of design history, up to that standard. And this course was part of that.
When it also, I don't know him, so I'm just getting a sense from what you're saying and what I've read, but I think it's just bringing all of this stuff to life, right? It's, you know, just having these things be living and breathing and not too rigid or, you know, overanalyzed or defined. And I think, I mean, the thing I feel with what you do, and it's something that I couldn't be more passionate about, but just so many of the fields are just kept kind of in silo from one another. You know, everything's cut off. You know, art doesn't really interact with science, and that doesn't interact with technology. And you realize these things are all cross-pollinating all the time. It's very hard to talk about one field and just it be covering that very specific one field. And I think, you know, someone like Christopher sounded like he really also was bringing that subject to life for you outside of the kind of usual dry, you know, teacher.
Absolutely. Very, very true. And I think the structure of the course, which, you know, presumably he had either designed or fed into, it brought all of these different aspects together. Because, as you say, looked at on its own, you get a whole different view. It is interesting because obviously, you know, with certain subjects, the depth of study necessary means, you know, it's very difficult these days to get the breadth and the depth in some things. And you need both, I suppose, is what I would say. You know, some things really just need, you know, they can benefit from very, very focused study on a very small thing. But a lot of things benefit more, and for most of us, by a breadth of approach. And actually, I think it's one of the things about what we do in museums, which isn't really well understood, that there is no, you know, there's no one story. It's not like there's that object and this is the label is the answer. Depending on sort of where you're coming from, that label could be one of any number of things. And you can completely, you know, it's a bit like the news and the images. You can change the story according to what you want to say, what the story is, what your subject is, and so on. And I don't know. I think probably I thought, if I thought about it at all, which I probably didn't, I thought, you know, you get the information that is the right information, but that's just not true. There are many different ways of interpreting everything.
Well, and that goes back to your opening track, Ode to Billy Joe, because, you know, there's a song that has many interpretations of what that story is. So I find that interesting because obviously that's something you appreciate with work, you know, and how everyone can take something different. But having that as your opening track, I'm sure that maybe that opened up not just other worlds, but other stories for you.
Mm, yeah. And also, I think I said earlier that knowing all the words... You know, I just assumed that everybody knows all the words, but they don't. You know, some people do pick up on words and use them as a way to sort of lead them into places, and other people will have a different approach. But for me, certainly, the words were part of it.
So how did you first get into the V&A, and what was it like then? What kind of work were you doing? I know you were working at the Boiler House with this, it was a tiny team, and your mission was to put out groundbreaking exhibitions on unusual subjects in interesting ways, immersing people in the experience. Just tell us about that time.
Well, the Boiler House, which was the Boiler House, where the original Boiler House of the V&A was, hence the name, had been taken by Terence Conran for the new design museum. And so he'd fitted it up rather nicely. It was basement under the Exhibition Road entrance that was there then. And he had it for 2 years, and then he moved to the design museum, got its premises at Butler's Wharf and opened properly. And the V&A got back this space, nicely done up. And it became what was known as the 20th Century Gallery. And that's when I'd spent quite a lot of time in my degree at the V&A, and my supervisor had been at the V&A as the head of exhibitions. And it was he who'd just taken on this space. And, oh, just so lucky. I kind of started hanging around and helping, and I got some work making a film for an exhibition and so on. And I can't believe it now. I think there were three of us and the design team, which was also three. And we did four exhibitions a year. I mean, they weren't vast, but they weren't tiny either. And we did think we were doing the cooler stuff in London. I remember even our private view invitation, which was very slim, and we had special very slim envelopes, so you'd know it was coming from us. And we did a fashion surrealism exhibition that we worked on actually with MIT. We did something called avant-première, which was very... interesting French avant-garde furniture that included people like, you know, Jean Nouvel, who wasn't well known then. He was barely starting, I think, then. And we did Neville Brody of the Face. I don't think there was much going on like that in London or anywhere at the time. And we had complete freedom. And it was an absolute gas sort of getting the things together. And I remember sort of going around London and going and borrowing Gaia Dali's hat from somewhere in Kensington, and I remember a lorry getting stuck down a little street trying to deliver to our stores in Olympia. You know, pretty much mayhem. There was no particular system in place for the V&A then to do these exhibitions. So we made it up as we went along and had a lot of fun and did some really great exhibitions.
How could you ever leave that?
Well, it was really fun, but then I got married and we went to live in Paris. And the V&A rather brilliantly helped me get a job at the Louvre. And I mean, that was actually rather extraordinary because I went from a really very dynamic and creative and super fun role into the Louvre, which was, I mean, just amazing. I'll feel absolutely extraordinarily lucky to have had a year there, but it was a whole different story. You know, the system in France is very, very different, and the whole training to be a curator is, it's like a sort of civil service training, including legal training and so on. So anyway, very, very different and invaluable experience. Opened my eyes to how different things can be, even really not very far away. And also a lot of fun, but in a very different way.
Well, yeah, it sounds like you went from, you know, almost like the DIY punk scene to a music school or something like
yeah.
that.
To the conservatoire. No, exactly. And actually, I'm just remembering, we did an Australian fashion exhibition in our Boiler House gallery. It was really, really cool and amazing. And again, you know, some of the fashion designers we worked with, a really brilliant Sydney-based fashion curator. But we decided we would sculpt all the mannequins and had a sculptor, David Begbie, who worked in steel. He was literally just forging the ironwork. I mean, it wasn't sculpture so much as bent pieces of ironwork being forged sort of out at the back of the V&A. I mean, my God, health and safety now would literally, we made each mannequin for each customer. We sort of got them out and say, what would this look good on? Oh, we'll have somebody upside down, like diving into the water for this one. And he would make this sort of line figure in fantastic wrought iron, and on, you know, the costume would go. So it wasn't just the stuff we were showing, it was also the way we were showing it and the way we were able to evolve artists and designers in that, you know, in that process too.
So after your time at the Louvre, tell us how you came back to the V&A and ended up almost by accident in the theatre and performance department.
Yeah, it was by accident. I went back and said, got any jobs? And I had children by this time. And I said, I want part-time work. I mean, can you believe this? This is late 90s. And I said, no, we don't have any part-time work. And then in the theatre collections, somebody had gone off on maternity leave, and they did actually have, well, they were desperate. I mean, I don't, I don't think I would have got there had they not been utterly desperate, because actually there was a very advanced plan for an exhibition, but not a very, as in, you know, it was meant to be opening in 3 months' time, but the plan was not very advanced itself. And it was with Spiros Makoris, who was Melina Makoris's brother. Melina Makoris, a great Greek actress, so it was high profile as well. So I went in to work on this exhibition on ancient Greek theatre, feeling like a total imposter. But it was fun, and I found I absolutely loved the whole theatre collections scene. I loved all the people there. You know, it's quite a different vibe because, of course, it was about live performance, and it suited me down to the ground. And then I sort of never left, although I have sort of partly left now, but not even now, not completely.
And as you said at the start, you know, the V&A was really uniquely positioned to do these shows that you went on to curate, because it had had the foresight to collect items from music and performance since the 1960s. But no one had really thought to use these music-related objects. So when did that idea first occur to you?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I'd like to say, you know, there was a eureka moment and, you know, I said, do you want 10 times as many people to be interested in our museum, or don't you? And off we went. But it wasn't actually like that, because it was a sort of combining of two things. I think one thing was actually doing quite theatrical immersive exhibitions, and the one that sort of sticks in my mind because it was quite tiny, and it was very collaborative, and it was working with a photographer who'd photograph people in their dressing rooms. And we decided we'll show the photographs in the dressing rooms of the theatre, and we will dress them as if somebody's just walked out of the room with, you know, the lipstick and the messages and the full ashtray and all of that. And hey, also, why don't we actually commission a play, a sort of soundtrack play, so that you not only get that, but you also can imagine what actors are thinking in the half hour before they go on stage. And we put it all together, and it was great, and it was noticed, and it was popular, and it got great reviews, and lots of people came to see it, and even won a prize. So I think many of us have been trying very hard to story tell in the most interesting way possible. And there was that going on the one hand. And then there were these amazing music collections. And, well, Kylie actually changed everything, although I can't take any credit. Well, I can take actually credit for doing the exhibition in London, but it came to us from Australia. And I think everybody was thinking, is this right for the V&A? But the Kylie exhibition went on in 2006, greatly modified for its London showing to pick up on all the young fashion designers she worked with. She was working with Akram Khan at the time, you know, to actually look at how the sort of ecosystem of performance and how it, and also what it is to be a live performer and go on these massive tours. But anyway, so it had a lot to recommend it, but there was still nervousness. But we opened, public poured in. I think there were nearly 300,000 people in 3 months, which was a very high figure for those days. And the Guardian ran a poll to say, you know, should the V&A be doing this? And, you know, people thought they should be doing it. There was, you know, there were opinion pieces, etc., etc. But overall, it was a success. And I think without that happening almost by accident, I would have struggled when I went in and said, you know, hey, I want to do an exhibition on David Bowie now. But because of that, it had sort of laid the ground. And, you know, when Bowie came along, you know, we'd done a really lovely small exhibition with Annie Lennox and the Supremes one that you mentioned. But it was Bowie that was going to be immense.
So, yeah, tell us now how that Bowie show came to be, because, you know, I know the museum actually, even though it had all of these other, you know, music related items, it didn't have any Bowie or very little Bowie in its collection. So just tell us about that. And wasn't there something about Elvis dropping out as well?
God, well, you obviously have either done your research very, very well, or I've told you all sorts of things in the past. Or both, probably both. So, yes, we were going to do an Elvis show. I had met the curator from Graceland at, I was doing a talk, I think, after the Supremes, doing a talk in America. And she came up and said, would you be interested in Elvis? And I thought, oh, God, would I just be interested in Elvis? I still count that as one of the sort of great sadnesses of my career, is that I didn't do that show, because I do think there's such a tale to be told, and that he hasn't been done a great service by the way stories have been told about him since his death. You know, one could do something amazing. Anyway, that was going along, and then Elvis Presley Enterprises was bought by another company who were saying, why would we spend 2 years? And they wanted to go back to their way to do things quickly and cheaply, and not the V&A way, which is to do them slowly and very, very expensively. So that was off the cards. And just in the gap, I mean, literally between thinking, having actually got it through with the director, who was not a pop music man by any means, but he was a visionary and, you know, he understood also what he didn't understand. Got it without it being his bag, I suppose. But he had not heard that Elvis was falling through. And sort of in the meantime, we, Jeff Marsh, who was keeper of theatre and performance, and I were invited to a meeting by the outgoing deputy director, who didn't say what it was about. And I remember I had to go on somewhere else and was sort of thinking, oh, what is this? Why am I going? And going in, and there were two people there, Bill Ziesblatt, Bowie's manager, financial manager, not music manager, Sandy Hershkovitz, Bowie's archivist, and they showed us their collection, which was, I mean, I cannot tell you. I mean, they had a computer, you know, and showed us the files, and I remember it as if it was yesterday, because, as you said, we didn't have very much stuff in the collections, and the reason, well, one of the reasons was very little had gone out onto the market because Bowie himself had hung on to an awful lot of material and had been not only hung on to it, but had also been collecting in this area. But I had not known, wasn't common knowledge, that he had created a proper archive of his work, something like 75,000 objects. And they had it. It was in New York. And they wondered if we would be interested. And I remember leaving the room saying, I can tell you without needing to ask anybody that we would definitely like to do a show about David Bowie. And I remember thinking, I have no authority to say this. But anything less seemed, you know, to underplay the moment when you got an opportunity like that. But indeed, I then got another opportunity to present it as an idea at the same time as saying, sadly, Elvis had fallen through. And everybody was just overjoyed. Well, I say everybody, I'm sure not everybody was overjoyed, but it got the slot that had been reserved for Elvis. And suddenly we were off in what would count as probably the shortest possible timescale to do an exhibition at the V&A, which was just over 2 years.
Wow. 75,000 items, 2 years.
Yeah.
And was Bowie involved at all in the show?
We were told early on that he would not be involved at all, which was, well, it was a disappointment, and it was also something of a surprise, because anybody who knows about how Bowie worked kind of knew that there was no album cover, wasn't even a merchandise that went on tour with him, wasn't overseen by him, and probably a part designed and everything else. You know, he was meticulous in that. So it's an eternal question, and I think it's been answered. I met him, but only after the exhibition was over. We worked with his team, and it wasn't sort of like a team that you would get with a lot of pop stars or bands. It was a very, very close-knit small number of people who were very close to him. And I certainly, from time to time, had the impression, or indeed was certain, that ideas that we put forward were taken back to him, and the next day you would get you'd say something and there'd be an absolutely no response at all. You know, we were thinking of designing it in this way, and they wouldn't respond at all. And the next day they would say, we like the idea of this, we don't like the idea of that. And you think, oh, is there somebody, is the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain? But it's hard to explain. I mean, on the one hand, I felt that we did the show from start to finish ourselves. On the other hand, I feel that the sort of hand and spirit of Bowie was so deeply involved in it. And because I came to know so much about the ways he worked, that there were even the spanner in the works type way of working. When he was recording, he would sometimes use the oblique strategy cards that had been designed by Peter Schmidt and Brian Eno, that involve things like, you know, all the musicians changing instruments to introduce a sort of element of surprise and, you know, stark horror into the proceedings to just shake it up a bit. We had, those things did happen along the way. It was by no means plain sailing, and that all seemed in the end to be, you know, felt like it could be part of some great scheme. But who knows? Like, you know, Bowie is so sort of preternaturally amazing and brilliant that you can ascribe all kinds of possibilities to him, and then maybe it was accidental, and all exhibition in development have their ups and downs and so on. But it was quite an adventure, and we also were hugely aware that there was so much expectation, and ironically in the museum world I think there was a sort of expectation that we couldn't probably really do it, couldn't do Bowie justice in a museum setting, and it would fall rather flat in a sort of museological way. And I think from fan, I felt you can't please all of the fans all the time, and that we're bound therefore to potentially upset more people than you've satisfied. So it was absolutely fraught with challenge, which made it all the more unbelievably wonderful when we opened and people started coming in, and you realised, oh my God, we've got not just a success on our hands, but we've got a mega success. Still makes me smile and immensely proud, and, you know, also overwhelmingly a feeling of how lucky I was to have sort of got that gig to work on.
Well, I think the gig was lucky to have you work on it, Vicky. So, and I'm not just saying that. There must have been many memorable parts of the show or just discoveries in the archiving process, but was there any one that really stands out?
Yeah, I think when you're doing an exhibition, you need almost a sort of ethos. And there's a sort of concept within the story, but there was also to push everything to the limit, but also to unsettle people and things, to sort of shaking it up, shaking those expectations up. And one big idea we had to do that was actually that you would arrive in a white cube gallery with art from the late 60s. So we had a sort of Carl Andre, not the bricks, but tiles on the floor. And we had John Cage's music. And so when you arrived, it was sort of almost like you'd arrived at the wrong exhibition. But the point we wanted to make was that art appears in, you know, many different guises. I mean, I only mention that because it lasted for the V&A show. It didn't go anywhere else. We put so much effort, you know, you put so much effort into every little bit, and then you're aware that some bits absolutely sing and it can't do without. Some bits, it doesn't really matter one way or another. And then a few bits, a few people notice and it blows them away. And it's kind of the mixing up of all of those elements in an exhibition that I think make it, or can make it, magical. It's not one thing for everybody. Everybody has their own journey. That's the sort of great thing. And you need to present all of those things. We worked really, really hard. We just didn't stop that entire time trying to make it better than it already was. And along the way, the discoveries within the archive itself were amazing. You know, we suddenly found that Bowie had wanted to create a musical on Diamond Dogs and had done some filming himself and started to create it, and that film was just sort of sitting there. And so we were able to take it off the cutting floor, as it were, and create a little visual of that, show, you know, what he'd done and so on, as another way to, you know, illustrate the breadth of interest that he'd had and the way he would just try new things. Even if he didn't know how to do them, he'd just work out how to do them, learn how to do them, teach himself how to do things he didn't know how to do, in a way that we all could if we were curious enough and actually applied ourselves. So it was a sort of continuous, exciting journey like that, because the archive has all the famous things that you expect to see, but it's the other things that make it so perfect and so magical and so ideal for a museum such as the V&A, that's all about the process, because you actually can illustrate how ideas came about, how they were developed, and how it's not easy. And I think that, you know, that's really something I hope people take away with them, because it is a call to all of us. Things aren't easy, and them being difficult doesn't mean you shouldn't do them. You just have to try a bit harder. And Bowie really tried really hard. He worked incredibly hard all the time. So, you know, that was a revelation.
Well, I don't think any listeners who are tuning in for this are going to be surprised that in 2016, the V&A won the Museum of the Year award. And we don't really need to say much more than that, having spoken to Vicky, because I got to say, Vicky, I'm sure that is very much down to your forward thinking approach with, and having done like three very successful shows, including David Bowie's, which, by the way, now has toured the world and has, you know, 2 million worldwide visitors at this point, probably no doubt more than that. So let's now move into a kind of perfect territory for Bowie, which is, what music would you like to send into space?
And that, for me, is Life on Mars by David Bowie. As a single, I used to listen to at school with my best friend. She had her brother's turntable and that single. And we'd listen to it kind of all day long.
Perfect. And now we're going to take a listen to Life on Mars by David Bowie.
Take a look at the old man reading up the wrong.
And that was Life on Mars by David Bowie, and that was the music that Vicky would send into space. I bet that young Vicky had no sense that she would go on to create a very special section of your exhibition for that song. Tell us about that.
Well, I think one of the wonderful things about exhibitions is that it doesn't all need to add up. With Bowie, we did decide not to be chronological. We decided to be thematic, which allowed us to go where areas of interest were. But then for one area, we had the absolutely beautiful blue suit that he wore for the amazing video of Life on Mars, which, if you don't know it, I'm sure you know it, PC, but it's just amazing. It's Mick Rock, who sadly recently died. And it was made in, I think, 72. And it looks so modern. I mean, it could have been made yesterday. But we had that. We had Kate Moss did an amazing spread in the blue suit for Vogue. We had the lyrics of Life on Mars. And I was kind of thinking, how am I going to include Life on Mars, especially because it means so much to me because of it being really the first Bowie song that I really kind of got to know. And then I thought, well, actually, we could just make a special section for it and it would sort of fit here. And that's what we did. And nobody said, hang on, why is Life on Mars? I mean, it did, you know, broadly it sort of fitted in. But it was lovely to have it there just for that reason. With all these spectacular objects, it worked really, really well as a start of the second section of the exhibition.
Wonderful. And I think it's no understatement to say that show definitely changed your life, right?
It definitely did. And along with remembering where I was when I first met Bill and Sandy, I also remember working in the sort of early stages of the exhibition, talking to a lot of the creative people who've worked with him, going out to meet them, tracking them down, going to have conversations, and finding that people who maybe had worked with Bowie for sort of 3 months or 6 months, sometime in the 70s, had in a sense not got over it, and thinking, God, that's a bit sad, isn't it? So such a long time ago. And then subsequently realising that I am now one of those people. You do not get over it, because being in the slipstream of somebody like Bowie, it is a wonderful thing. And that exhibition for sure changed my life. And not to in any way sort of do it down, but as I was saying before, I and colleagues had been doing interesting exhibitions on interesting subjects for years, trying really hard. There's no doubt we tried harder than ever for Bowie, but it was having this perfect subject, to have the perfect subject, and then to do your very best, and to have this absolute aim to do the best exhibition there has ever been. You put all that together and you're in a very good place to have a life-changing experience, which is what it was.
And looking at our beautiful blue marble, imagining now we are in space, how do you feel right now about, you know, so other key topics such as the climate emergency? Because I know this year at the London Design Biennale, which I was very happy to be involved with, again with you, any chance to work with you, Vicky, you know, the theme was design in the age of crisis. So, you know, how are you feeling about where we are right now?
Well, just actually to hark back for a moment to the Revolutions exhibition and the late 60s, where there were amazingly a lot of the same concerns, obviously at a different stage and, you know, not an emergency, but already a lot of care and attention being given to climate change. What is different is there was so much optimism then. There was a real feeling that we had it in our grasp to change the world. And that was what I sort of loved about that time and working on the exhibition. A lot of young people then, the demographic worldwide was just, you know, in favour of young people. What I feel sad about now is that there is so much less optimism for very good reasons. I've got, you know, four daughters, all passionate environmental warriors, have been for years. You know, they're all either vegan or vegetarian. They don't fly. And they do not have the overwhelming sense of optimism and everything getting better and it's going to be all right that the 60s kids had. I just feel sad about that. And, you know, the climate emergency, if there's no world, it's sort of the only game in town. It isn't, of course. I have other concerns, social equality and health and so on. But I feel more than any time in my lifetime, we are all very, very focused on this one thing.
And what is the song that you would have at your memorial?
Oh, God. So, well, I chose a much more upbeat song, although it does make me cry. So I absolutely love Stevie Wonder and always have my whole life. I just think he's a complete genius. And the song As, having said I'd like to have been a backing singer, I'd like to have done those rounds as well in the back of As. I just love this song. And I love the way it goes on and on. It's one of those songs that I think for a long time I didn't quite notice it. And then it suddenly sort of shot to the fore. It's the most fantastic love song. It's also so sort of hopeful about what lasts in life. And I guess those are the reasons why I'd have it at my memorial. So people would, I hope, laugh, cry and dance a bit and hug each other. And that makes me smile.
Okay, well, let's take a listen to As by Stevie Wonder off Songs in the Key of Life.
Time knew to move on since the beginning, and the seasons know exactly when to change. Just as kindness knows no shame, nothing for your joy and pain, and I'll be loving you always.
And that was As by Stevie Wonder from the record Songs in the Key of Life, and that was the track that Vicky would have play at her memorial. I guess what I notice is every song there's something of a medley and mixture, and you know, these words keep coming up in terms of the way you describe the music. And I think it's the kind of brain or appreciation you have, which isn't one thing. It's, again, it's that whole sort of cross-pollination and cross-conversations and the mixing of different, you know, things and mediums and, you know, all of that.
Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, I think we were saying at the beginning, you sort of, it's hard to deconstruct and analyse what it is, you know, what it is that speaks to you in music. But there's a fantastic quote, it may not even be about music, writing about music, like, you know, dancing about architecture or something. It's a completely different quote. I think about different things, but there is that element that kind of is what it is. It's hard to put it into words what that does to you, your feeling about it. But boy, you certainly know it does that.
And talking about the key of life, how do you feel about, well, the opposite, I guess, which I actually don't think is the opposite. I think it's a new chapter. How do you feel about death?
I'd like to put it off as long as possible. I think my father was the only person in my life who used to occasionally say, I'm not frightened of death, you know. And it's such a taboo subject, really, that, you know, you don't get to talk about it very much. So as a result of not really talking about it, I think it might be quite hard to sort of say I'm against it. You know, I feel immensely lucky to have had a very nice life and continue to be having a very, very nice life. I just hope that when it comes to death, I've got a very ancient and much loved relative who's in her 90s, and I think, do you get to the stage where you think, actually, I'm ready now? I'm not even sure she's still doing sort of super things, but probably it feels different then. I don't know. What do you think, Lucy?
Oh, I'm quite open to the idea of it. But I think I'm also a curious fish, because I think I remember before I was born. I'm not going to say I think. I do remember before I was born and actually deciding to come down. And then I remember being in my mum's tummy and being born. And, you know, as a baby and a kid, I never felt like a person. So I don't know, as in, again, to, yeah, we won't go there. Yeah. But I definitely think this life is not, you know, I think we think of ourselves as having a life, and we think of ourselves as having this identity, but we don't have a life. We're part of life, you know, and the identity part is often a bit of a distraction. And I think we're much more connected than we realize. And so even with Bowie leaving, because that's what you were talking about, that loss, I think also the loss of that person as a human being can also be an activation of their presence in a bigger way, in different ways, and in the people who knew them. I definitely experienced that with a very dear friend who passed away, who was so alive and vital, but I feel her all the time. So I think we don't really get the full picture.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. You know, I certainly agree that it activates more in the people behind. And it's a wonderful thing that people continue to live after they've died in their effect, and the effect that they've had on the world and in other people. And it's, you know, it's both sort of immeasurable and it's minute. because it's such a big world and so many people have lived, and that's sort of all part of the wonder of it. And I also don't believe that it's all one thing after another as well, the sort of temporal direction. I can think that lots of different things can be going on at once in parallel. But that sounds completely bonkers.
Oh, no. No, nothing's too bonkers for me. No. You don't even know how bonkers I can go, Vicky.
I can imagine.
Changing subjects slightly, with the digital landscape changing so much and not always for the better, what do you see the role of curation being going forward? And with the fake news and the noise, you know, I'd say it's more valuable than ever. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, God, so many things in that question. I mean, in terms of sort of digital, I'm really interested in the possibilities of digital. I mean, the capacity of the human brain, well, both to create these things, but then also to sort of live within them and take experiences from them. I find all of that quite fascinating. I guess we weren't originally designed for this. We seem sort of endlessly adaptable in so many ways. So I think that's all quite interesting. I think the need for curation and sort of clear knowledge, on the one hand, I find it sort of terrifying. I also, and again, you know, the 60s exhibition, a real sort of tutelage in understanding how the idea of sort of sharing knowledge equitably and no one being in charge could have been such a sort of ideal. And yet, you know, it's such a mess, you know, and working out how that's kind of affected politics and so on, you know, people on the far right and the far left who actually have a surprising amount in common around those ideas. So I think it's immensely complicated in terms just of day-to-day life. I find the fake news thing terrifying, and I find the cancel culture really distressing, because for me, universities and so on ought to be spaces where people debate things. They don't just sort of shut them down. I do get there are other arguments and, you know, other ways of looking at them. I think it's a really, really tricky one. But I think there are things that need to be sort of thought through and worked out in defence of there being space for, well, for debate, certainly, and also for not closing people down completely if they say a silly thing.
I completely agree. You know, I think we need to be able to have conversations, and we need to also find more ways of building bridges rather than divisions and silos. I think also that, you know, the thing about curation for me is just when you've got so much stuff out there, you know, obviously the digital era opened up worlds of noise, and where everything's sort of hitting you at the same frequency and not necessarily going in deep, you know, and staying with you. And so when I think about, like, you know, obviously the Bowie show is kind of the epitome, but you think of every person that passed through that. And I mean, I know even from the show I did of my album designs with you at the V&A, just the way that those things can go in and go in really deep when they're kind of hitting a different pathway in the brain, because, you know, you're not quite sure what it is. And it's sort of combining these different, it's interactive and it's visual and it's, you know, tangible and it's sensual and it's all these different kind of sensory experiences. It's so much more impactful, I think, in a time when we're, you know, just taking everything in this sort of one stream where nothing really is differentiated.
I completely agree. And I suppose I take for granted that I have particular ways and areas that I sort of look to for guidance. I mean, without guidance that I have, the places I go, you know, I just can't imagine what it would be like. But it's definitely moving in the direction where that may not be sort of mediated, or you may not trust who's mediating it. And you need all of those things to be working properly to make it work. I mean, it's just quite interesting that when we were doing Bowie, we actually almost wanted to do the opposite. We didn't want to do the opposite of curating, but so conscious were we of the multiple different opinions and ideas about so many things. Like, we had mad ideas, like we'd have three labels for every object so you could kind of choose which one you wanted. You didn't kind of just get our word for it. You know, we printed other opinions on the same things as sort of faded text and stuff. Anyway, stuff that probably nobody noticed, but just sort of shows all the things that go through your mind when you're creating something like that.
Anti-curation, I love it.
Yeah.
So what, Vicky, this is now your last music choice for your Orange Juice for the Year selection. What is the album that you'd pass on to the next generation and why?
Yeah, so for this one, I've chosen Back to the Beatles. Your questions were so deep that I had to sort of go deep, and it felt anything, you know, things felt a bit frivolous otherwise. So Back to the Beatles and these things that, you know, I first heard when I was very young, and Revolver, the song is Here, There and Everywhere.
Perfect. So we're going to end with that in just a second. But first, Vicky, what do you feel the thread is that connects all of your Orange Juice for the Year choices?
Well, I think, Beatty, you've kind of summed it up, but I'm not sure that I would have cottoned on. I think the majority have unclear stories. That's very well put. They sort of open you up to possibilities, but they don't close you down as to what those possibilities could be. They take you on a journey, but you don't know where you're going. Actually, not really this last song, which is just the most sort of beautiful love song. But the others, I would say, do that, take you on a journey.
And you chose this record because you said this is one that you like to play whenever you arrive someplace new.
That's right. If you arrive in a city or a new hotel room or whatever, and you go and put some music on, and Revolver is an album that I put on at times like that, and it just sort of gets better and better, I think. So after all these years, I'm still with it.
And what would you say the essence of your, even to call it curating, feels like somewhat limited and limiting. What would you say the essence of everything that you do is? What is your intention with your work?
Well, I'm really passionate about it and want to do the absolute best that I can, at the same time as not feeling that I want to just, you know, tell people things. I want to lead them if I can. I suppose it's part of taking you on a journey as well, on the understanding that you have just as many things to sort of add to this experience as I do. So it's not a one-way thing. So I think it's that conscious, and sorry, this is not very succinct at all, but I think I am very conscious of not just what I want to say, but of your point of view, you, the audience, the viewer, the visitor. You all have your own points of view, and I'm conscious of that and want that to be involved.
And thinking about art and humanity today, big question to almost end on. What do you think we've gained and what do you think we've lost? Let's say in the digital era.
Oh, well, okay. Now, I can say it easily, actually, for the music. And it's interesting, actually, just going back to your sort of curation question before. I suppose, you know, we curated our own music collections when we had however big your album collection was. Mine was massive. But nonetheless, it wasn't everything. And now that I have everything at my fingertips, just much less good. And that's a whole lesson in life.
Yeah, the thing I love in that, because I've thought about this a lot, I think human beings fundamentally need limitations to appreciate things. But in terms of our thinking, in terms of our imagining, it has to be limitless. So the imagining has to be completely open and expansive, but what we can actually access has to be limited.
I completely agree. And it works in all kinds of things. And I remember being quite young, going to someone's house, and I said, when's lunch or something? And they said, oh, you know, it's fine. Nothing's planned. We just do everything when it happens. And I remember spending the rest of the day wondering when lunch would be and thinking, God, it's much better at home where you know when lunch is, because then you can do anything you want with just that one fixed thing. You can build everything else around it. I remember it striking me at the time as being more freedom despite a constraint, being more freedom because of that constraint.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's different but similar.
This year, I did mention it earlier, but this year, you know, you held the London Design Biennale 2021, Design in an Age of Crisis, and that was obviously meant to be in 2020. What would you say with the big themes being communicated, and, you know, how did it feel to put out that show in a year when no other exhibitions really happened? Lockdown stopped a lot of that.
It actually felt a really joyous moment to open at all in June. And it was, I mean, you know, harking back, we again thought things were getting better and we hadn't been out for an awfully long time, and the sun came out, and to mingle with other people and to see things in company with other people and have discussions. And it was absolutely thrilling, and I guess more thrilling than it would have been if we hadn't just had a pandemic. But it was also, I was highly conscious that kind of in the meantime, we had learnt these enormous truths. And, you know, one of them was that we were not going to be free of this until everyone was free of this. And that was something that spoke very directly to the Biennale theme of country, inter-country, borderless communication and collaboration. And, you know, that's always been our theme or big theme or the way it works. And yet, you know, I felt we've had this visceral demonstration of the truth of that, that nobody has been able to escape, alongside other big, big truths coming out of a catastrophic state of the environment, the need to work on big things like social equality and health across the world. And again, to finish back in the 60s, the one world politics, the idea of the sort of Buckminster Fuller, we're all travelling together on Spaceship Earth, and we need to kind of look after it and look after each other, speaks very strongly to me. That's what I believe, and that's what I think came through this summer.
Amen to that. Last question. What is it you hope to leave behind with the work that you've done and the work that you're continuing to do?
Oh, I don't know. Bring a little bit of joy and happiness into people's lives. It's hard to say. We've moved, you know, maybe moved along the way of doing things. And I just really enjoy continuing to work in that way and to open more doors for more people without ever, you know, I can't even bear the term dumbing down or kind of limiting things because you want to appeal to more people. That's totally sort of against my philosophy. I think opening up, doing it really well, and getting more people involved and interested is what I've tried to do, and hope I have done.
I think you've done that in spades. So Vicky, thank you so much for joining us today. And we're now going to close the show with Here, There and Everywhere from the Beatles' Revolver. And Vicky, thanks once again.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Beatty.